It's Damien. Great news, it reads. Mike and I have been talking. We're going to give it another shot. Okay if I bail on dinner tonight so I can go to his parents? Oh, come on. I tell my phone to tell Damien that of course it's okay, and then I put the bird in the oven, retreat to the cool dimness of the dining room, prop myself up at the bar and stare off into the distance, feeling sad and lost and frustrated. It's not that my brother's well-being occupies every waking thought, but that with Pete so happily settled and me far pickier than I am lonely, Charlie is the person that I want the most for. He's the best friend of my best friend. The boy who taught me to whistle. The man who was by my side when we mourned. I know him better than anyone in the world. And he knows me like no one else, too. He was absolutely right about me, of course. I didn't answer the phone today because I didn't want to say no, and I wasn't planning to say yes. Now here I am, alone in my restaurant, pouting, and looking for some way out. But there isn't one. I'm not going to eat prime rib without my siblings, and I'm not going to let my beloved nieces go without a pretty turkey, even if they're too young to care. I'm going to nut up and go to Thanksgiving at Emily's. And when it's time to clear up after the meal, I'm finally going to have the talk with my brother. It won't be easy, and I won't be popular. But I will have done the right thing. For Charlie, for our family, and most of all, for Annette. Chapter 8. I'm not exactly wasted when I arrive at Emily's house. I can walk and talk and carry a 28-pound bird up her rickety porch stairs, but I'm not stone-cold sober either. The afternoon has flown by in a turkey-basting, champagne-swilling blur, and though I don't intend to bring it up unless absolutely necessary, I have boiled a large pot of potatoes for mashing and made a beautiful mushroom galette. Both are back at the restaurant, should the other provisions somehow fall through. Okay, yes, and I also baked a pie. Fine, two pies. Inside at the far end of the bright teal living room, I see Jeremy, a miserable look on his face, setting a dining room table that I recognize. It was my parents, and then Annette and Charlie's. It looks out of place here, with its high-gloss cherry finish and upholstered chairs. But then again, aren't we all? Jeremy is putting down the plates as though they're made of lead, as though someone has asked him not just to set the table, but to forge the silverware and blow the glassware as well. He looks positively exhausted by the process. He's also putting the forks and spoons on the wrong side. Hey, Jeremy, I say. Turkey still in my arms. How are you?
I have to set the table, he tells me glumly. And wash the dishes. For every meal. For the rest of my life.
Oh, okay then, I say. And decide I better leave him to it. I walk into the kitchen and set Rich down on the empty half of the stove. On the other side, I note something gluey in a pot. And a dirty saucepan full of burnt-on marshmallows. Oh, boy.
Sophie, calls Emily. I'm so glad you're here. Come get a hug. My goodness, we were a bit worried you wouldn't come. I said, Charlie, give this woman some real credit. Do you have any idea the trouble she's gone to over the years to feed you and your brother through thick and thin? I think she'll do what's right for her and for the family as best she can.
She puts down a grater and reaches her arms to me. Obediently, I step into her arms, feeling the tight squeeze and smelling coconut oil. She pulls away and there's some fuzz from my sweater on her hands.
Oh, she says, I think I should have washed my hands first. I'm very sticky. Did you see the boys out front?
Just Jeremy, I tell her. He seems to think he's in a state of indentured servitude.
Oh, for heaven's sake, she says. That boy is lucky. He still has his life. I could have killed him when I found out what he did to Charlie's car. I mean, I am not the kind of mom to go off on every little thing, but I was livid.
What do you mean? What happened to Charlie's car?
He didn't tell you?
Oh, wow, you guys haven't talked, have you?
It's only been a week, I say. More like a month now that I think about it.
Well, I'll let him tell you all about it. He's out back. Do you want to go say hi?
I look around the kitchen. Don't you need any help in here?
Don't be silly. All under control. Go talk to your brother. Oh, and tell Smush if he's out there that I need him to make sure all the small stuff lying around is packed away before Pete and Keiko get here with the baby, and tell him I'm going to check his workbook. He's always desperate for me to check, even though he's doing an amazing job. I think he's picking up your brother's scholarly streak, if you want to hear what I think.
Like Thumper before me, I say nothing. Just head out. The back door opens to the high-fenced backyard. Through it, I find Charlie, Smush, and, to my surprise, Pete playing basketball on the hoop Charlie mounted to the garage. We hug all around, even Smush, who was in the habit of jumping up and wrapping his legs around my knees mid-hug, so that I either have to catch him or let him crash to the ground.
Oof, I tell him. You're big.
I'm growing like a weed, he tells me. I'm going to play for the Bulls someday.
To prove this, he shoots for a basket and misses by at least 5 feet. I smile and tell him his marching orders, and Charlie tells him to go do it now. I'm surprised to see him immediately obey without a word of complaint. What happened to your car? I ask the moment Smush is inside the house.
It's nothing.
Didn't sound like nothing in there, I tell him, gesturing to the kitchen with my head.
Emily's making a big deal. She's mad, but she's also sheepish, I think. She told me the car would be safe in the garage.
And it wasn't?
I left it open for like 2 hours. Jeremy must have sensed a disturbance in the force. He immediately went out to sit in it, knocked it into neutral, and got out. The force of the door slam got it moving, and then he watched it roll forward into the lawnmower and all the bikes.
Pete can barely control his glee.
Oh my God, what I wouldn't have done to see the look on his face when that happened.
Charlie laughs.
I know, right? I told Emily we should have installed closed-circuit video. It would have made the whole thing worth it.
Wait, are we talking about your MG? Your British Racing Green MGB with no rust? Didn't you just put a new tonneau on it?
The cloth top is fine. It's the bumper that's done for. He shrugs. I should never have converted to chrome.
I gape at him.
This is the car I'm not allowed to drink water in, right? How is that boy still breathing?
Charlie looks at Pete.
It's a life lesson, eh, Pete?
Yep. I promise you, based on some life lessons of my own, that was one of the worst moments of the poor kid's life. He won't touch that car again. Besides, Charlie can say goodbye to dish duty for years.
Charlie nods.
And I won't have to mow the lawn either, or clean the toilets. I'm a man of leisure now.
Wow, okay. Good attitude, I guess. It seems my brother has had a lobotomy since we last saw each other. Then I realize who's missing.
Are the girls here yet? I ask Pete.
Nope. Morning with Keiko's mom. Can we all say a mighty hallelujah that they bought a condo in town and be glad it wasn't our parents moving back?
I laugh. Keiko can be easygoing most of the time, but she and my mom are oil and water. Probably because my mom thinks Keiko is too hard on the kids, and Keiko thinks my mom is going to wreck them with sugar and inappropriate TV. Both are a little right. But it all comes out in the wash.
So? Are you going to tell her?
Pete asks Charlie.
Tell me what?
Charlie gives Pete a look, and I immediately become the left-out little sister with two conspiring brothers.
Tell me. Tell me now, I demand.
Charlie shrugs and reaches into the pocket of his jeans.
Ta-da,
he says, and pulls out a small velvet jewelry box.
I gasp.
What is that?
It's a ring, Charlie laughs and opens the lid.
It's Grandma's ring, I exclaim. You've got to be kidding me.
It's one of Grandma's rings, he says.
This is true. My mom's mom, rest her soul, was fickle and could only live with a ring for a decade or so. In the end, there were probably 5 settings and 2 center diamonds. She left them all to my mom.
who offered them to us on a first-come, first-served basis.
I don't need it, says Pete, so I told him to have at it.
And Grandma was still with us when I proposed to Annette, says Charlie. So I figure two diamonds, two of us, he gestures at me and him.
Mom said fine.
Upon reflection, it's reasonable. What's not reasonable is the thought of him marrying Emily. Why are you doing this, Charlie?
Doing what, the ring? I just told you. I thought you'd be cool with it.
Not the ring. I don't care about that. I'm probably never getting married. Help yourself to the ring. Just don't give it to her, I say.
Charlie looks at me dumbfounded.
Oh, please, I say. Don't pretend I'm the crazy one here. Do you really want to marry into this family? I mean, I know you're in love, but remember you were in love with Nikki once, too.
Pete gasps.
Uh-oh, I think I hear my baby crying, he says, and immediately vanishes into the house.
Such a coward. Your baby isn't even here, I say to the swinging door.
Charlie leans back and crosses his arms.
Please tell me you didn't just compare Emily, who is kind, hardworking, and a wonderful girlfriend and mother, to my maniac college girlfriend.
I cross my arms in front of my chest.
So what if I did?
I think you're drunk. Simmer down.
I'm not drunk, I say. I'm drunk adjacent. And it doesn't matter because I've been thinking about this for years now, as you well know.
I well know, repeats Charlie. This is coming out of nowhere. You've never said anything before. I mean, not since, like, 2 years ago.
I have so. I've hinted, like, a million times. She's needy and messy and never travels and can't ski. She has two kids, and you've avoided kids your whole life.
One of them crashed your car,
and you spent the entire summer sitting in family court fighting over them with a man who isn't worth the goodness in your left pinky toe. What about this woman has you so beguiled?
Charlie gapes.
Are you kidding me?
She's generous and caring. She thinks about my needs all the time. She's savvy and unafraid and never panics, no matter what. She has given me my own family. And besides,
he pauses for a second.
Wait, what am I doing? I'm not going to sell my soon-to-be fiancé to you. It's how I feel about her that matters, he says.
I agree, I say. But how do you feel exactly?
And how do you think you're going to feel in 10 years? You'll be in your 50s. You'll have biannual sabbaticals. Are you going to spend them working doubles at the Walmart so you can put someone else's kid through technical school?
Hey, if you're suggesting that I'm too good for them, I'm too good to work at a discount store or have a kid in community college, then screw you. Stop being such a snob.
I'm not a snob, I say, though admittedly I am coming off as one right now. I'm someone who cares. I want you to have the life you dreamed of. Travel, adventure, freedom, not some dysfunctional Brady Bunch thing that feels a million miles from who you really are.
You don't know who I am, he says,
and his voice has grown angrier.
You know who I was before. A lot has changed. What I want has changed. That's what it means to truly grieve and move on.
I shake my head at him.
People don't change that much. They're either right for you or they aren't.
Spoken like a middle-aged woman whose last long-term relationship was in college. Go on, Sophie, give me some more romantic advice. I'm listening.
Oof. Drunk adjacent or not, that one hurts. I start to feel the fight draining out of me. In its place, a desperate need to retreat surges in.
Screw you, Charlie, I say. All I'm trying to do is look out for your happiness. You don't have to be so nasty about it.
Look out for yourself for a change, he says. And get back to me when you actually know what you're talking about.
I can't think of anything to say back to that. And I'm wilting from the hurt. I shake my head at him and head back for the house. I'm thinking all these injured thoughts. I should just take the turkey and go. I should get Keiko to back me up. I should tell Emily to her face that she's derailing my brother's life. I should.
I know what I really should do. Have a strong cup of coffee and give up on Charlie. I really should.
But as I think that, I walk into the kitchen and see a horrifying sight.
Rich, the turkey, not the man. He's on the stove still, sitting on the right side burners. The ones that were out of use when I first walked in. Except maybe one of the burners was in use after all, because spattered grease from the roasting pan seems to be climbing up the back wall of the stove, and that grease is the distinctive black and orange of a kitchen fire.
Chapter 9. I've had a few kitchen fires in my life, and I know what to do. Firstly, scream, then open the kitchen door and scream at Charlie, then close it again, no need for air circulation to make things worse. Then I run back to the stove, cut the heat under all the burners, and start looking for baking soda. I find some in the back of the fridge. Good girl, Emily, and start caking the bird and the stove with it. The fire dies enough on the top of the stove for me to drape the turkey in a wet towel. Then I take off my sweater, which has enough acrylic to be potential torch material, and start pulling out the electric oven from the bottom so I can get it unplugged and douse the drywall flames. The moment it's out, Charlie runs up with the fire extinguisher. I move the food and he sprays the wall, and we both look at each other and sigh in that heady cocktail of adrenaline and relief.
Holy crap, Charlie says. What did you do?
I look at the oven, the back covered in white-gray foam. Did I set a tented turkey on a burning stove? I mean, it's possible. I'm half a bottle of champagne in. I open my mouth to say as much when someone interrupts me.
It was me, says Emily, appearing under the kitchen archway. I just put the heat on when I left to go over Smush's worksheets. I meant to put it on under the green beans to warm them back up, but I must have put on the wrong burner. Oh my God, I'm an idiot. I'm so sorry, Sophie. I am so sorry. Is the turkey okay?
I look from her to Rich. He's covered in a layer of flame retardant, then a wet towel, then baking soda. He has seen better days. But Emily's face is cracked in half with guilt, and I can't make it worse.
I bet we can salvage him, I say. The house didn't burn down, and that's what matters.
I say it thinking it will make her feel better, but instead she looks even more defeated.
Oh my goodness, you're right. I could have burned the house down, she says.
But you didn't, says Charlie.
And he puts an arm around her.
We got your back, right, Sophie?
He gives me a death stare I recognize from when I was threatening to flush his G.I. Joe's arm down the toilet when I was 7. Remembering the swirly I got that day, I nod.
Sure, all's well that ends well.
Her shoulders relax and she exhales.
Okay. Thank you both, you're amazing. And here's me trying to be amazing to impress all the Dickinsons, and I am so scattered I blow up the turkey.
Then she gives a sad smile to Charlie.
On the upside, we could finally do a backsplash. Think of how nice that would look behind the oven. I guess we have a use for that leftover drywall from Jeremy's little outburst.
I raise an eyebrow.
Simmer down, Sophie, says Charlie. The kid is 16 and in the middle of a custody battle. He kicked his bedroom wall when he found out his mom was sending him to therapy.
She nods.
And thanks to him, I learned to install drywall, which, I mean, that's a super useful skill, right? Besides, good counseling is worth the fight. He's been evening out by the day since we found the right person.
Oh, I say, thinking of the poor kid. The courthouse trips, the man who isn't his father trying to act as if he were.
That's good news,
I concede. Emily smiles.
Things are getting better for everyone in the family, she tells me. My lawyer says we're about to reach a settlement with my ex. Smush is so much happier with the new medication, and Charlie's new course load is working out beautifully. That new summer seminar took it out of him.
I look at my brother. It's true that he looks better. No more dark circles, no more sallow skin. How is it I didn't notice that?
And you?
I ask Emily.
Who cares about me?
She asks, with a little laugh.
When your family's happy, you're happy. It's the complicated codependency of parenthood, right, Charlie?
I look at my brother in shock. This is the first time I've heard him referred to as a parent. He looks immeasurably proud as he nods and says,
"Strange, but true."
Emily looks around the room. Somehow in the hubbub of the fire, I didn't realize Keiko had arrived. And now Pete is here too, sagging under the weight of my little niece, who is the fattest baby the earth has ever seen. Tucked behind Keiko's legs is Nettie, who says,
"Oh, wow, Mama, are we having a s'mores?"
What can we do but laugh?
"Well then,"
says Emily after a moment. And she raises her shoulders and then drops them in a massive,
"What can you do?"
kind of shrug.
"If everyone's here, why don't we get seated and try to salvage this meal before my boys gnaw their own arms off?"
Unflappable, this woman. Never mind half the food is covered with ash and spray foam. Time to eat. Obediently, we each turn to a job. Keiko asks Nettie to set the baby's place, while her mother hauls up a high chair from the basement, letting Jules roam the living room carpet. Pete starts opening wine, giving me a,
"Don't even think you're getting a sip," look as he does.
Charlie gets a mop and bucket for the retardant on the floor, and Emily starts carrying out plates of unappealing but somehow untainted food, green bean casserole from a can, pasty mashed potatoes, oranges, grated pith and all, stirred with store-bought cranberry sauce, and, inexplicably, a small bowl of still-frozen peas. I head to the cutting board to try to find something edible about my turkey. If even a drop of retardant had hit him, he'd be toast. But the wet tea towel and foil have protected every inch of him. Still, he is clammy, wet, and dusted with half a box of baking soda. He looks about as appealing as the insole of a running shoe after a 10K. Still, deep down, he's a big bird and there's more to him than looks. I find enough unscathed meat under the skin for everyone to get firsts, and then carry the tray out when everyone is seated. This is how I always like to do it, but this time, there is no sharp inhale of reaction when sight and aroma combine. It could be because the house smells like wet, burnt drywall.
"Oh, well," says Keiko into the silence. "Still tastes great, I bet."
I plop down, defeated. We raise our glasses, mine of water, in a toast. We say what we're grateful for. We start passing dishes. I begin to psych myself up for eating this unfortunate-looking meal. And then, into the silence, Keiko screams. Everyone drops everything in a crazy clatter.
"Jules!" she shouts.
She is out of her chair in an instant and picking up the child. Every head turns toward the baby, and we see that she is blue. My heart stops.
"What did you swallow?"
Keiko shouts at the child. She puts her hand down the kid's throat, swiping her mouth, but nothing comes out. Nettie bursts into tears.
"Pete!" Keiko cries. "Call 911!
"Hang on," says Emily, and she rushes to Keiko's side. In fast but somehow relaxed motions, she takes the baby from the poor flailing mother and sits on the side of the sofa, placing Jules in a seated position and leaning her forward slightly. She feels her face for breath, listens to the baby's back. Then, to my horror, she whacks my baby niece's back about as hard as you'd swat a magazine at a fly. We all gasp. Nothing happens. Pete is holding his phone tightly. Keiko is starting to turn blue herself. I think of what to do, but nothing, absolutely nothing, comes to mind. The boys are gaping, horrified. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Jeremy almost absentmindedly pull Nettie into his lap. Charlie and I exchange a terrified glance. Emily, on the other hand, looks calm. She pulls back, and bam, whacks the kids back again. I send up a silent prayer. Miraculously, an orange and brown projectile comes flying out of the kid's mouth so fast it hits the front window with a wet squish. And then, the best sound ever rips through the silence. Baby Jules starts to sob. Keiko bursts into tears.
"Oh, thank God," she says. "Thank God,"
over and over again. She is sobbing.
Nettie's in Pete's arms now, and Charlie's hands are pressed against his chest as if to slow his heartbeat. Emily looks over the baby carefully, swipes her mouth, and then hands Jules to her mother. Her arms wrap them in a quick hug, and she encourages Keiko to hold the baby close and snug to her chest and try to breathe.
"It'll bring the adrenaline down," she says, "for both of you."
Pete, too, starts to cry, and he and Nettie join the hug. As for me, I watch in shock as Emily, still cool-headed, reaches down to see what the baby swallowed. She picks it up, and her eyes turn into red lasers pointing at Smush.
"Justin Matthew Hall,"
she says in a dangerously quiet voice.
"What the H-E double hockey sticks did I tell you about picking up your toys?"
I look at what she's holding, and I would know it anywhere. I keep it in a high cabinet with my potato ricer and Grandma's Sterling gravy boat, things I only get out at Thanksgiving. The cloth turkey. I reach into my pocket for it, even though it obviously cannot be there. And when my hand comes out, only the name tag itself, still faintly reading Annette, in her own perfect writing, is between my fingers.
"Emily, it was me."
She looks at me and then at the small novelty turkey.
"This is yours?"
Charlie looks at me amidst the chaos, eyebrows furrowed.
"Is that?"
I nod.
"Annette's place card, from that last Thanksgiving together, yes."
Emily looks from Smush to Charlie to me. She wraps her son in a hug and tells him she's sorry to have suspected him. All that fury has fallen away, and what's underneath is the same babbling woman who lit my turkey on fire, but with this pervasive kindness that I somehow didn't see before.
"Oh, Sophie," she says.
Keiko is only blubbering now, and she turns to Emily.
"You saved her."
Pete comes over and congratulates her by slapping her on the back almost as vigorously as she slapped Jules earlier. Charlie stands up and wraps her in a hug.
"Baby," he says, "that was amazing."
Emily shakes her head with a little smile.
"Thanks to you, I'm one semester away from being a nurse," she says. "This was excellent practice."
"Charlie, you dummy, she's too good for you," says Pete. "Why have we never had a medical professional in the family before?"
He turns to Emily.
"Are you sure a hero like you wants to settle for my idiot brother?"
Charlie turns his arms up.
"Hey, I just put out a literal house fire. How much more heroism do you need to see here?"
Emily laughs.
"If it weren't for your wonderful brother, I would have had to drop out after the summer we had. Instead, I'm about to finish school, and after my tests, I'll start bringing home the bacon for myself," she tells us proudly. "I call that some pretty decent heroism on both sides."
Charlie beams. I wipe away a bit of snot threatening to break loose from my nose and clear my throat.
"Keiko, I'm so sorry, but that turkey she choked on was mine."
"What?" She looks at what Emily is holding in her hand. A child's toy, if ever there was one.
"I keep it with me every Thanksgiving. It's just a dumb memento. I came here so tanked, I must have let it fall out of my pants pocket. I'm so, so sorry."
Keiko takes the turkey out of Emily's hand, turns it over in her fingers.
"I think I remember this. Was it hers?"
Embarrassed, I nod and produce the missing tail feather.
"Oh, Sophie,"
Keiko says. Her voice is softer than I was expecting.
"Poor Sophie. We were all so worried about Charlie after Annette passed. But it was you who never bounced back."
I open my mouth to argue, but then realize how true it is. And the tears I was managing to hold on to come loose.
"She was my best friend. My only friend, really."
"Oh, please," says Pete. "What are we, chopped liver?"
"Your family,"
I say.
"You have to be nice to me."
"We're a lot more than nice," says Charlie. "We put up with all kinds of your crazy. That's how much we love you."
I look at him.
"What do you mean, my crazy?"
"Come on, sis," pipes up Pete. "You know you're not perfect.
A different guy every month, an obsession with work, a complete disinterest in moving out of our parents' house.
They said I can live there as long as I want.
But why do you want that? Asks Charlie. The time I was there was like being 17 again, and not in a good way.
That's because you were in a little bedroom full of spelling trophies and Star Wars toys. I sleep in a big girl bed.
You sleep in our parents' bed, supplies Pete. The same exact bed, never mind how weird that is. The mattress itself is older than I am. The least you could do is replace some furniture, clean out some rooms for your own use.
My parents have said this to me 100 times, but for some reason, I never really heard it before now. And yes, maybe I am a bit obsessed with work, which I do truly love. And yes, I don't date the same guy more than 3 times on principle. And yes, I have deliberately avoided making meaningful friendships since Annette died, so maybe I am the crazy one here. Should we take Jules to the hospital? I say, desperate to change the subject. I think we're okay, says Emily. The baby at this starts giggling. Keiko, if it would make you feel better.
She shakes her head.
Look at her, she says, gesturing to the toddler, smacking her in the collarbone playfully. It's like nothing happened. God, kids are resilient. If I got the Heimlich over Thanksgiving dinner, I'd be doing whiskey shots and booking daily appointments with my shrink and my pastor.
What's a whiskey shot? Asks Nettie.
Whiskey is water that makes you throw up and burns your stomach, says her father.
Maybe we all need whiskey shots, Emily suggests.
No, I shout. I'll have a whiskey shot, says Jeremy, who, though generally angsty, hasn't so much as pilfered one of Charlie's beers yet.
Good luck with that, little man, I say to him, and he glares at me. Trust me, no whiskey till you've got all your hair down there.
Oh my God,
he says, mortified, and I grin at him.
I think maybe, just maybe, I would be an excellent auntie to this poor hapless teen. I'll toughen him up in a jiffy. Then, Charlie can play, well, if not good cop, slightly less embarrassing cop.
Let's leave the whiskey conversation there for now, says Emily.
Agreed, says Charlie. Why don't we all settle back in and try this dinner thing again? The mashed potatoes are getting cold.
It really can't hurt them, says Emily. They're the texture of something you'd use to hang wallpaper.
I let out a relieved laugh. I think this means I won't have to eat them.
And guys, continues Emily, what even are French fried onions? Do you use them in any other context?
Keiko shakes her head.
Believe me, we did not have those in our house when I was growing up. The first time I ate them, I thought I was being punked. They taste like crunchy air.
Are they just what you get if you strain the oil after making funyuns?
Ugh, that's disgusting, says Jeremy.
And then after a moment,
Mom, do we have any funyuns?
Everyone is settled in now, laughing, back at the chairs where we started, except now the only thing that looks as good as it did when we first started the meal is the frozen peas, which...
Emily, why are the peas still frozen? I ask.
That's how they're supposed to be eaten, says Smush. A lot of people don't know that. If you warm them up, they get soft.
With a smile, he shovels a handful of them directly from the serving bowl into his mouth.
Oh, honey, says Emily. At least use a spoon. Remember I told you? Queen's manners tonight.
He ignores her.
And I also like the green beans, he says, reaching his grimy paw for them too.
Pete, quick-witted as usual, smacks his hand away and dishes him a large serving with an actual spoon.
Me too, says Jeremy. Grandma makes them, but she uses little dishes and puts Swiss cheese on top.
The adults all look at each other in mock horror.
No offense, Sophie, but you should try these beans instead of the weird ones you make. These are way better,
Jeremy adds. I stifle a laugh.
Next year, I say evenly. Next year, I can make ramekins of it for the kids. We can eat something with truffles.
So you'll cook again next year? Oh, thank God,
says Emily.
Please never make me cook this meal again.
I furrow my brow.
But
Charlie said,
Charlie was trying to give me what I wanted, and look, I was trying to prove to you guys that I could be a decent partner and feed your brother and host your family and all that other wifey stuff, but you guys, I don't like to cook, especially not on Thanksgiving when the pressure is through the roof. On Thanksgiving, I just want to enjoy the people I'm with. I don't want kitchen fires and baking soda turkey and wallpaper paste with a side of crunchy air.
Everybody laughs at this. Even me. The champagne drunk is almost worn off. I'm sitting here with my family, who love me, even though I suppose I am kind of ridiculous, and who are also bizarrely, unusually, insanely, and luckily, my truest friends. I guess, when pressed, I have quite a few things to be grateful for. But just as I'm thinking that, the doorbell rings.
Chapter 10. Emily looks up from her plate. Charlie looks at her, then pulls out her phone and starts swiping. He just installed a video doorbell a few months ago. After a few seconds, he looks up at Emily and nods quietly. The doorbell rings 3 more times in a row.
Should I get that? I ask.
No, Charlie and Emily shout in unison. The doorbell rings again.
Okay. Charlie looks at Pete, more intensity in his eyes than usual.
Hey, Smush, Jeremy, guess what I have hiding in the garden shed?
I don't know, a body,
says Jeremy with a tiny smile.
Close.
A new N-Strike Elite Strong Arm Blaster,
he says. 2, actually, and 2 extra bandoliers.
What?
Asks Smush.
Are you serious?
Pete, go take the boys to the backyard. The blasters are behind the wheelbarrow up on the wall. They're out of the packaging and all ready to go.
Pete looks at Charlie, just a beat, then immediately nods. Whoever's at the door starts pounding. Pete leaps out of his chair and practically runs to the kitchen.
Get a move on. Last one there has to give me a turn.
Smush bolts, and Jeremy, wising up to whatever it is they all know and I don't, goes along too.
You okay, Mom?
He asks as he turns to go.
Never better, she says with a casual smile.
The door bangs again, and we hear the back door open and close. Both Charlie and Emily exhale.
I'm going to get it. I'll send him away, says Emily.
Send who away? I ask.
Emily,
says Charlie, ignoring me.
He's probably drunk.
Emily narrows her eyes.
So was your sister, and I handled her, didn't I?
Let me talk to him, says Charlie.
I'm trying to decide if I should be offended by the previous comment when Emily gets up from the table, ignoring my brother.
You don't have to fight my battles for me. This is my problem, and I mean to solve it somehow. Maybe tonight.
She slips a bare foot into one shoe on the mat, and then opens the door slowly, putting her shod foot about 8 inches behind the swinging edge of the door.
You're stealing my own children from me,
says a voice into the opening. I finally realize who it is. This is the ex they've been arguing with in mediation all summer. The guy who wants his kids back despite his obvious disinterest in caring for them. His voice is angry and loud and slurred, too.
I know you're upset, Sean, says Emily, but this isn't the right way to handle things.
Let me in. I want to see them.
They're not here right now, and even if they were, is this how you want them to think of their dad?
Her voice is calm, patient, and more than a little sad. Nothing like the gibbering and nattering I'm used to hearing from her.
They need to know who I am, he cries out. They won't know how much I care about them if they don't ever see me.
They know you care, says Emily. But caring isn't enough to make a good parent. You have to take care of them, too, if you want to have placement. And you're just not ready for that.
This angers him.
Don't you talk to me like I'm the crazy one. You're the one who picked this fight. You're the one who had them dock my pay.
He's shouting now, and Keiko has gathered up Jules and Nettie and is retreating to the kitchen.
I suppose I could go with them, but I'm not a mother first.
First, I am a sister.
We should go over there,
I say to Charlie, quiet under Sean's belligerent barking.
Tell him to get lost.
She wants to fight her own battles. I look at him sharply.
If you are going to marry this woman and take on her drama and her kids and her mortgage, then guess what, bro? This is definitely your battle, too.
Sean is getting angrier. Emily's voice stays soft and calm. Charlie looks at me resolute.
I am going to marry her, he says. I don't care if you like it or not.
I inhale and say what I need to say, not just because I am his sister, but because of a promise I once made to my best friend.
Well, then I guess I don't care if I like it or not either.
I'm on board from this moment on. All this time, Emily is standing at the door with her foot and hip keeping it closed, and Sean is shouting random diatribes at her from half in and half out.
Really?
Charlie asks me.
Yes, really. What do you want from me? Go over there and kick some ass. I've got your back.
I mean that metaphorically. Of course I do. And yet my brother strides over to the front door like Wyatt Earp. He announces himself to Sean, tells him to go away, reminds Sean that the judge has warned him to give Emily and the kids space. Emily, still wedged against the door, now looks tired and grateful to see Charlie at long last. Her body relaxes. At that exact instant, Sean gives the door a heavy kick. Emily falls to the floor, leaving the door undefended. Sean blasts through immediately. He runs up to Emily, grabs her by the shoulders. He is so angry, I swear I can see the heat waves rising off of him. He shouts at her.
What are you even doing with this guy, Emmy? Why is he parenting my kids? What about me, Emmy? What about us?
You gotta let her go, man, says Charlie.
Screw off,
says Sean, still holding Emily's dress with one hand, dragging her around to face Charlie.
Let her go, please, or I'll have to ask less nicely, said Charlie.
Frozen 15 feet away, my hands go up to my mouth.
Like hell you will, says Sean,
and he hauls back. Emily reaches for his punching arm, but he swats her away, hard enough that she runs into the wall behind the door. Sean drops his arm. I exhale.
Ah, Emmy, he says. I'm so sorry, Emmy. I didn't mean to do that.
He helps her to standing, puts his hand on her face.
You gotta stop touching her, buddy, says Charlie.
And he takes hold of Sean by the shoulder, this time his own right hook ready to go. But my brother is a lover, not a fighter. The punch he delivers between Sean's shoulder and his collarbone only seems to wake Sean up. In response, he punches Charlie in the gut, hard. I swear, I feel it in my gut, too.
What the hell? I say, standing up so fast my chair falls out behind me. I look around for something heavy,
find the bottle of wine Pete emptied into glasses. I grab the green glass neck and head to the door, realizing I should have done this when the man was first yelling at Emily, not waited for the punching to start. That is, after all, what I said I would do. I said I would get on board. Well, here I am, bottle wielded like a club, dripping on my sweater, ready to knock a mofo out. Before I can get there, Sean punches my brother again, right square in the eye. The force sends him straight to the floor. At this point, I swear to you, I think I can break this bottle over a table like a cowboy in a bar fight. I go full Amazon woman. I shout some curses, I think. I might even scream. My rational mind vanishes, and a maniac Avenger mind steps into place. I run up to that man, and I'm about 2 heartbeats from beaning him with an empty wine bottle right over the head. And I would have done it too, if only I'd had the time. Chapter 11.
Whoa, 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 shouts a stranger behind Sean on the porch. Everybody freeze.
I lower my weapon, not just because the speaker is a police officer, but because I'm scared as hell of actually hurting someone. Sean wriggles in place. I see that his arms are pinned behind him by a second cop, and behind the two officers on the porch are a pair of black and white patrol cars, lights on. I put down my would-be bludgeon and take Emily in a half-hug, pulling her tight to my side. Then we both crouch down to check on Charlie. "They never freeze when I tell them to," says the officer to her partner. "It's like the freaking K-9 unit. Is it all about having a deep voice? Is that really such a huge deal?"
"Well, try it lower," says the partner.
His voice reminds me of something.
"Everyone freeze, now!
Please!"
she tries. Emily and I both stop and look up at her.
"See," says the partner. "Much better. That said, if you don't mind a note, next time, try it without the please. Just to see what happens."
"It's just not my style to drop the common courtesy," she says, putting zip ties on the immobilized Sean and then handing him to her partner. She introduces herself, I instantly forget her name, and then asks,
"Everyone's safe? Unharmed?"
"My brother got clobbered," I say, and he starts moaning. "He needs ice and some Advil."
"What about you, ma'am?"
she asks Emily.
"I take it you know this guy?"
She nods. "Ex-husband, not one of my finer choices in life, but I'm totally fine. Shaken up, that's all."
"You don't want to go in to be checked out?" she asks her.
"I'm a nurse, almost. Anyway, I'm fine."
"Glad to hear it. Who else is here?"
"Us," says Keiko. With her is the baby who is laughing as though nearly choking to death, witnessing a house fire and being attacked by a madman has made for the best day ever. "And my preschooler, she's outside with my husband and her boys," she tells all of us, especially Emily. "Everyone's safe and sound."
My sons, Justin and Jeremy," explains Emily, relief transforming her face.
"The reason he came over, custody dispute."
"Oh, well, luckily they happened to be out back when this happened," says the officer.
Emily and I look down at Charlie in unison. "Charlie made that happen," she says. "He's such a quick thinker, comes from all the adventure travel, I think."
"Anyone want to bring me a steak?"
says my brother from the floor. His face is turning purple and orange.
"You look like a sunset," says Nettie, reappearing from the kitchen. "Why are you bleeding, Auntie Sophie?"
We all look at my sweater.
"It's not blood," I reassure her.
"It's Bordeaux. It's like lifeblood."
"How about you, little warrior? Any nerf injuries?"
Squealing, my niece lets me pick her up and flip her in a circle looking for bullet holes. Emily lets in both officers, catching them up calmly now that her ex has disappeared into the back of one of the patrol cars. Keiko gets permission to put herself and the three littles in Emily and Charlie's room with a movie. And Jeremy comes in and hugs his mom with sad, sad eyes. I set down Nettie and send her in to watch Ralph Breaks the Internet. Then I turn to Jeremy and take him aside so his mom can talk to the police. "I know you're busy at the moment, bud," I say to him. "But I have an idea about how you could earn extra money, not just to pay back my brother for his car, but maybe get some wheels for yourself." He looks at me, surprised.
"Really?"
I take him to the table far away from where Emily and Charlie are giving their statements and tell him about my plan for him to come work after school at the restaurant.
"Am I old enough?"
he asks with wide eyes. "Please," I say. "It's not child labor if it's a family business, right?" I take a side glance at Charlie with his arm wrapped around Emily and a bag of iced peas on his eye.
"And your family.
Plus you're 16, and I'm not planning to have you making martinis behind the bar." He looks at me like I'm some kind of all-powerful god.
"I'm not going to use the money for a car," he says. "Just so you know, I'm going to give it to my mom so she can pay back Charlie to make up for what my dad owes her."
I drop my hands on the table. "That is insanely sweet, buddy. But you don't owe anyone money on behalf of your dad. You are two completely separate people, and now that I've met both of you, I can safely say you have basically nothing in common." His eyes drop.
"Are you sure?"
he says. I shrug. "You're a great kid. I have every faith in you,"
Why else would I be willing to hire you? I'm interrupted by a tap on the shoulder.
Sophie?
I turn around and find myself looking into the blue eyes of a man I'd nearly forgotten about 2 years ago, and wondering how that was ever possible. Dane?
Just thought I'd say hi before I go. I wasn't sure you recognized me in all the chaos of the moment. How are you doing?
My jaw drops. Dane, in his uniform, is a tall glass of Scandinavian water. I say, suddenly empty of words. How?
Luckily, Pete breaks in on my eloquence. Hey, Dane, long time no see. If you don't count the turkey last year. Okay, people, let's clear this mess up.
Pete gestures to the table where I sit.
I've got 6 pizzas on the way, 1 for every kind of pizza eater, even my wife's disgusting broccoli mushroom pie. Jeremy, you haul dinner part 1 to the kitchen. I'll set new plates. You joining us, officers?
They look at each other. I frantically start sending a message to the universe.
It's Thanksgiving, adds Pete, who apparently is playing the role of the universe tonight. How can you turn down a traditional Thanksgiving pizza?
Dane's partner shrugs.
Maybe we could stay to, monitor the situation? Pizza's 5 minutes away, says Pete. We definitely need at least that much monitoring.
It's decided. Charlie starts handing out wine glasses to the off-duty among us, and this time, even I'm allowed one. I accept it gratefully because I'm pretty sure I have a hangover at 7:30 in the evening and now require the hair of the dog. Proud moment for me.
Keiko comes out from the bedroom and gets a glass herself, downs it in one, and then announces,
Crap on a cracker, what a night. I'm a hysterical mess. My children, however, can barely keep their eyes open.
She takes one more sip of wine and then goes on.
Your young man, Emily, seems to be going strong and requests 4 slices of plain cheese when it comes. He can't eat 4 slices of pizza by himself, can he?
Oh, girl, she says. You just wait. Jeremy can kill a whole pie. Perfect, said Pete. 1 for me, 1 for Charlie, and 1 for Jeremy, and the rest of you lot can share the other 3.
I roll my eyes.
We'll see.
You grow up with 2 boys, you learn how to eat 2 slices at a time.
Bring it on, says Charlie. I'm famished. You need a lot of calories to be some guy's punching bag.
Or to be my hero, says Emily. She plants a juicy one on him. Charlie looks at me, 1 eyebrow arched, as if to say, see? And maybe I do see. I mean, you'd have to be really self-absorbed not to notice that behind Emily's nervous babbling is a woman who can cope with just about anything that comes her way. Behind her relaxed parenting style is a mother who knows how to fight when the chips are down. Under her need for Charlie's support is a woman eager and more than ready to stand on her own 2 feet. That said, beneath her bad cooking is just more bad cooking. I can't wait for this freaking pizza. I grab Charlie from her and drag him into the kitchen where Pete is looking for napkins. I hand him a roll of paper towels and tell him to get out. Then I turn to my other brother. I'm sorry, I say. I was out of line.
You were trying to be loyal, Charlie says. Believe me, I can recognize that. The number of hours I've laid awake wondering if this new thing I'm doing betrays what me and Annette had. Well, I could have gotten a second PhD by now.
And how do you know you're not betraying her? I mean, her memory. What she wanted for you.
Well, for one thing, I think she knew exactly how this was all going to go down. She and I both thought our life was pretty perfect. And both of us were totally blindsided by that last diagnosis, make no mistake. But in other regards, she always saw 10 steps ahead. Even when the rest of us were just bumbling through the day-to-day, trying to survive the thought of losing her. And she saw me play with her nieces and nephews. She knew a tiny part of me wanted a tiny part of that. And that part would only keep growing.
I look heavenward. She was just so insightful and independent and forward-looking.
And Emily's not like her, I know. But here's the brilliant thing about Annette, he says.
She was insightful and forward-looking and independent, yes. But she was not that modest. I bet she knew full well I'd never find another woman like her as long as I lived. That's why she gave you such general marching orders.
I look at him quizzically.
Think about it, says Charlie. When did you ever know her not to be precise and exacting? She could have told you to set me up with that lady from the tax office, or an older woman who had just passed the kid's stage in life, or a younger one who hadn't even started, for that matter. But what she told you was to make sure I wouldn't be alone. I don't like to be alone. That's not who I am. And I withstood it before I met Emily because no one else could have possibly measured up to what we'd had, Annette and me. But now, with Emily, I can't imagine my life going ahead any other way.
I look at him. Then I want you to go ahead. You know she irks me sometimes. She's not how I imagined things. But if you love her, then I'm going to love her too. She's going to be part of this family.
Charlie hugs me, big and warm and real.
I wonder why I was being so stupid. Then I remember. The problem is, Charlie, I can't really figure out how I'm supposed to go ahead. If I'm not trying to run your life or protect Annette's legacy, what exactly am I supposed to be doing?
Pete walks in just then. I was wondering when you were going to ask that, he says.
Are you eavesdropping?
Nope, just letting you know the pizza is here. Opportunely, and suggesting that you come and eat it with Mr. Hot Cop out there.
Pete, I say.
He's right, you know, says Charlie.
Go out with a decent guy for a change, Dane or whoever. Let him be nice to you. Take an interest in him, see what happens.
Pete nods. And while you're at it, spend more time with your nieces. Don't wait for us to bring them to you all the time. Come over and bring chocolate chips and bake a big batch of cookies. Teach Nettie how to mix biscuits and Jules how to cut the dough. Go with Keiko to get your nails done or whatever it is she wants to do when I take the kids out on Saturdays. Get a little less involved in what you don't want for us and a little more involved in what you do.
I look up at him, surprised not just by his words, but by how wonderful they sound. I love those girls so much. Why wouldn't I go see them instead of waiting for them to show up to the restaurant once a month? Why don't I hang out with Keiko more? She's great. She's fun and funny. She definitely cares about me. Why on earth don't I take her calls?
Charlie nods. I'm not asking you to go get pedicures with Emily, he says. Not yet. But having Jeremy at the Little Plum will be incredible for him. Smush loves hanging out with you at the park. And as for me, I miss you. Living at Mom and Dad's sucked, but I did love having my sister around again.
I laugh. You just like my cooking.
Yes, and, he says, laughing back. Speaking of, says Pete, we've got to eat pizza and then... Charlie, you ready for this man?
Pete gestures to Charlie's pocket with the ring box.
Ready as I'll ever be, Charlie says.
And then he touches his eye, winces, and says,
how could she say no to this face?
And so, the most unforgettable Thanksgiving dinner of my life was spent with a plate full of anchovy bacon artichoke pizza, a uniformed ex-boyfriend, a burnt smell coming from the kitchen, and a G-rated movie blaring from the other room. It was spent with my best friends, their kids, a woman I didn't know quite as well as I thought, and two members of the local police force. It was spent laughing and toasting our survival of the night, hearing stories of the cops' craziest holiday calls, and watching Jeremy taste some wine and then rush to the sink to spit and wipe his mouth out with a wet paper towel. Somehow, that morning had started out so wrong, but in a series of alarming emergencies ended up exactly right. Maybe it was made right when Emily jumped up mid-bite and said, oh, and came back out with the place marker. The turkey that poor Jules almost suffocated herself on, and an extra plate, which she set together in an empty spot at the table.
Do you still have the name card?
She asked me. And of course I did. In silence, everyone watched as I placed Annette's spot at the table. A new tradition, that we'd honor for years to come. Or maybe it was when Charlie got down on one knee and took Emily's hand and asked if she'd be his wife. And she said yes, and I made a toast to the happy couple. Maybe I helped make it right when I told them that though Annette was in our hearts forever, I hoped that Emily would be at our Thanksgiving table for all the years to come. That said, it also could have been when, many hours later, after all the kids were in bed and the adults had their feet up on the coffee table in front of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I got a text message. Dane's shift had ended, and he wanted me to come out to the front porch, preferably with two slices of pie. And then I did, and he was there, looking to catch up and see if maybe, possibly, there was something to be had between us. Something that, until just today, had never truly been a possibility for me. But now it was. However, if I'm being totally honest, it was probably when Dane leaned in and kissed me right there on the rickety stairs of my future sister-in-law's front porch. Softly, warmly, addictively. And only stopped when we heard cheering, looked toward the window and saw Pete and Keiko and Emily and Charlie waving at us like crazy, giving us both the thumbs up.
This has been an Audible Originals production of You Can Thank Me Later, a novella, written by Kelly Harms, performed by Lauren Fortgang, executive producers David Blum, Catherine Stewart, and Mike Charzik, editorial producer, AOP editor, creative owner, Laura Blackman, producer, Kat Lambrix, copyright 2019 by Kelly Harms, sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.